Hey there, green future growers. Thanks for joining us today. If you're new to the show, I hope you'll subscribe on iTunes or your favorite Android app. And let's get to the show today, Greg Peterson.
Hey, thanks for having me, Jackie. I love that I'm chatting with you, so thank you.
Well, cool. Well, I am super excited. You know, so I call my audience the green future growers. And so my listeners are just people who are interested in growing a, you know, a more earth-friendly world and just taking care of our planet. And I know that you've been doing this for a long time now and taking care of your part of the southern part of the United States. So it's always exciting to have somebody like you to talk to. I just feel blessed to be the humble host and share the stories, and like, you know, I have like this inner desire to be a biographer someday. So
nice.
This is like getting to do all these little mini interviews.
Right.
That's
what we do as podcasters, is we tell people stories, right?
Absolutely. So, and I get to hear them first, so I feel a little spoiled that way.
But, oh yeah. Yeah. No kidding.
I used to be really good about keeping up. Like, I remember when I first started my first, like, couple of years, like, Sunday, I would still be looking for a guest to post on Monday. And in the beginning, I always had an episode ready. But this year with school, it's just been tough. So trying to get back into getting them set up. I was telling Greg in the pre-interview, I'm hoping to get 32 episodes recorded this summer. So I have September through December done, audience. So
beautiful.
We'll see if it goes. So
and congratulations on your success too. I often say that, you know, if there were thousands of people like you and I doing the educating and podcasting in urban farming and organic growing, that probably wouldn't be enough. Because I'm a true believer that the single most important thing we need to learn today is how to grow our own food.
That's so true. My husband really believes a lot of that too. And teaching our kids. So as an educator, like I helped run the garden club this year at my school, and it was really neat to see how that worked. And just, you know, trying to give the kids a connection to their food is important. And also, like, my husband would love to be a locavore, although I don't know how we could ever give up coffee, and I'm not about to give up chocolate. But, you know, there's just so much to growing locally. And just as much as, you know, you might not be able to grow everything, you might not be able to grow even a tomato plant is all, or herbs or something, but supporting your local farmers, I think, is important too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so tell us about yourself.
Well, I am 56 years old, and I planted my first garden in 1975, so I'd been 14 at the time. That same year, I wrote a paper on how we were overfishing the oceans. And now at 15 years old, how does a, you know, someone that age know we were overfishing the oceans? I have no idea. I just knew back then that there was a problem and that I could probably do something about it. And so fast forward to 1991, I made a couple of discoveries. And one of them, I'll tell you about when we talk about books. Another one was I discovered permaculture. And I like to call permaculture the art and science of working with nature. And in permaculture, what we do is we look at natural systems, then we mimic natural systems and kind of work in the flow of nature. Because we as human beings, we love to think we can do it better than nature. And I know without a doubt that nature always bats last. So nature will always have the upper hand. So we as human beings need to figure out how to work in that flow. How do we work with nature?
Well, I love the way you put that. And that's like a really nice way to describe permaculture. I had never even heard the term permaculture till I started my podcast. So it's really new to me.
Mm-hmm.
But I think a lot of the things we do are similar, or if not, just like fall right in there. So that's pretty young to learn about it. 1991, that's right when Mike and I got married, and or that's when we met, I guess. We got married in 93. But so, and you planted your first garden. And so did your parent, like, my one question is, like, you know, who were you with? Like, what did you grow back in 1975?
Right.
What were you doing planting a garden at 14? Did your parents garden?
Good question. So my mom grew up on a farm in Canada.
Oh.
And although she really wasn't the propellant forward for me to garden. She always nurtured that in me. And so when we moved into the Weldon house, we moved from a townhouse into a half acre in Phoenix, Arizona. And when we moved into the Weldon house is what I call it, Mom said, see the right half of the backyard. Now remember, it's a half an acre. She said, see the right half of the backyard, Greg, that's your garden. Go start digging. And other than that, and I've had conversations with her about it, and we both don't really know where the impetus for me to garden came from, or where the propulsion, you know, where the desire for me to garden came from. It was just there.
Interesting. Well, yeah. What about your grandparents? Like, do you think it was genetically inherited?
Good question. I don't know. I didn't really know either side of my grandparents. I mean, you know, it was one of those things where we'd go up once a, you know, right. once every 5 years in the summertime. So I probably met them three or four times. Mm-hmm. So one of the things, so I did an event recently where they asked me to talk about a childhood memory around mm-hmm. food. And what came up for me, I must have been 8 or 9 years old, what came up for me was my grandfather, who was Czechoslovakian, who did not speak English, and I didn't speak Czech. We were at the farm, and he took me out to the bee houses. And so I had this memory of being out in the bee houses and having him show me about the bees. And other than that, this is all self-generated as far as I can tell.
Wow. Well, that's interesting. And then you were like, you grew up in Arizona, so you didn't even really have an ocean, but you have this like passion for protecting the ocean. Like, where did that come from?
Yeah. So somebody about 5 years ago said to me in a lecture, because I'll often say, you know, how does a 15-year-old or 14-year-old in 1975 get this notion that we're overfishing the oceans, you know, you got to do something about it. And somebody said to me, and it hit me like a ton of bricks when she said it to me. She said, Greg, you were probably a great big fan of Jacques Cousteau, weren't you? And this flush of knowing came across me. So that's where I suspect it came from. Cause I used to watch, you know, he used to, in the '70s, he used to have a TV show.
Dude, I have a play about Jacques Cousteau. I love Jacques Cousteau. Nice. I love to teach my kids about Jacques Cousteau.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, of course I remember the TV show. I was I'm going to turn 50, so I'm just a little bit behind you.
Uh-huh.
So yeah, we watched it, and like remember the Disney World, the wildlife show with.
Oh yes, yes, exactly.
That guy, what was his name? And it would come on. And I remember sitting with my parents watching that show before the Disney station. Yeah.
So I'm thinking that that's probably where the notion.
That's so awesome.
The notion of the ocean.
To hear about that.
Yeah.
Because my kids are so funny. They love to do the Jacques Cousteau play. But the problems with it that I have is there's like two lead parts and then five little parts. And then I always end up doing it with second graders, and it's like a fourth grade play. So it's really, really hard for them to read, but they are so interested. You know, he's the person that invented scuba diving and underwater cameras and introduced us all to the world of the ocean and being an environment and an environmentalist. When I went to like high school, one of the girls who was a year above me worked for the Jacques Cousteau Society in New York. She spoke.
No.
She went to Tufts for language, and so she spoke fluent French, and so she was like their interpreter. Like they had like five people in their office, and she was one of them. I thought it was the coolest job ever. I was like, oh my gosh,
cool.
Yeah. Huh. All right. Well, so then, tell us more about Arizona and how you learned how to garden organically. Then.
Yeah. So, Arizona is in the desert.
Yes.
And, you know, just 2 weeks ago, it was 119 degrees here.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, yeah. You know, really, once it gets over 105, it's just crazy, stupid hot.
Yeah.
And we probably have, I'm going to guess we have a good 80 days in the summertime that go over 105.
How many days?
80. Oh yeah, I would say starting in mid-May to end of September, if we have a day that's under 100, that's a rarity.
Oh,
so growing food here is challenging in the summer. The good news is that the best time to grow is in fall, winter, and spring. And we actually have, I call it four growing seasons here. So we can grow, we basically can grow everything here. And the hardest time to grow things is the summertime.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So that's different than my situation.
Yeah, way different than your situation. Because you got, what do you have, 120-day growing season?
Something like that, if we're lucky.
Yeah.
Because you never know. You can get a frost. We had a frost. I want to say we had a frost on August 8th one year that knocked out all of Mike's green beans.
Wow.
Something crazy like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, you never know. Okay, exactly. So tell us what your some of your tricks then.
The big one is we got to plant shade.
Oh, how interesting.
Yeah, there are a handful of amazing desert plants, desert trees, Palo Verde, ironwood, and mesquite, all, by the way, which are edible, that make great nurse plants. So what we like to do is we like to plant these larger trees, the larger desert trees on the west side of a project, so that over the course of, you know, 3 to 5 years, they grow up. All of them give us filtered shade. They're not like a dense shade like an oak tree. They're a nice filtered shade. So it probably filters out maybe 60% of the sun coming in. And the other nice thing is that they can be pruned so that they're very umbrella shape. So you get, you know, a nice big trunk up the middle, and up about 10, 12 feet, you get this nice canopy that can reach 15 feet in both directions. So you can get these 30-foot diameter trees that help shade, especially in the summertime. So that's one of the tricks. Another trick is we have winter growing gardens, and we have summer growing gardens that are in different microclimates in our yard. A microclimate is a space that's cooler or warmer. And so in permaculture, what we like people to do is go out and observe, really pay attention to what's happening in your space, observe and take notes, and, you know, and then move forward from there. So for wintertime growing, we're looking for the warmer microclimates in our yard. And for summertime growing, we're looking at for cooler microclimates in our yard.
Isn't that interesting? So in the winter, you're looking for warmer microclimates, and in the summer, cooler microclimates.
Yeah.
Well, I guess that makes sense. It's kind of like people. I mean, like for us, it's like we needed most of our stuff to be out in the hot of the sun in the summer, you know, so it's getting the maximum growth. Although right now, you know, all our lettuce is ready to bolt because it's so hot. But for the most part, like Mike's been like cutting down trees. He's like, I need to cut down these trees so we get rid of, they're putting out too much shade. So, well, interesting. And I like the way, so then are those deciduous trees, or they bloom on your lawn, evergreens down there? Like, what kind of trees are they?
Yeah, great question. So the desert trees are semi-deciduous, so they'll lose some of their leaves in the wintertime. The cool thing about that is that they're also nitrogen fixers.
Ooh.
Yeah. Okay. They... you know, they take nitrogen out of the air and nitrogen out of the soil, put them into the leaves. And so when the leaves drop, you know, you have a nice source of nitrogen there that you can use for compost and, you know, just add it to your soil.
Nice.
Yeah.
Okay. And then what do you grow in those cooler microclimates or warmer microclimates?
What I did about 15 years ago is I put together my planting calendar. It's a desert adapted planting calendar. People can find it at plantingcalendar.org, but know that it is for low desert environments. And it tells you month to month what you plant then.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So in the fall, hardy greens like kale, Swiss chard, arugula can all be planted in August, September. Then the lettuces come in October, November. We plant brassicas in the fall, broccolis, cabbages, cauliflowers, snow peas, garlic, onions, beets, carrots, sweet potatoes. No sweet potatoes going in the spring. You know, those are the kinds of things that go in the fall here. And then tomatoes, peppers are a little bit more hardy, and they can go in January or February, knowing that if you're going to get a frost, you need to, or if it gets cooler here, you need to cover up your stuff. And then we plant all this summer stuff starting in March, you know, the pumpkins and cucumbers and watermelons and okra and corn and all that stuff goes in the, you know, March, April. And
Wow. When do you harvest watermelons then and pumpkins?
starting in June, July.
No way.
Yeah.
Oh,
Oh
weird.
yeah. I was gonna say we have, so I have a fruit tree program that I run. I educate people about fruit trees, and then they can get fruit trees from me. And all of our stone fruit, so peaches, apricots, plums, and our apples are all harvested and off of the tree by July 1st.
Okay, wait, you're going too fast for me.
Sorry.
Why are they called stone fruit?
Stone fruit. Anything with a pit in the middle of it is a stone fruit. You know, so like a peach, an apricot, and a plum, they have a pit in the middle. Almonds are actually stone fruit as well as our nectarines.
And
And
how to tell listeners and tell me about like your school that you have, like, is it an online school or like it's a school at your actual place? Or like, I know you
no, it's
told me a little in the pre-chat, but I don't think we told
yeah.
listeners anything, and
No,
I'm
that's
not really
okay.
sure how it works.
Urban Farm U is an online portal to learn how to grow your own food. We have currently have seven different courses that we offer, and every month we do free webinars on seed saving and growing your garden. And I have a buddy of mine, Jake Mace, and I, we do Ask Jake and Greg once a month, where we're, you know, basically fielding people's questions.
Can I
So,
ask you a question about
yeah,
that?
please.
I don't know. If you want me to take this out, I will, but like, so I like kind of want my husband to do that with me, like something like that. I'm like, let's jump on Facebook Live or try that, you know. He's so shy, I still haven't got him to do an interview with me. But like, so like, I know his big question is gonna be like, what if somebody asks us a question we don't know the answer to? Like, then what do you do?
Oh my God, those are the best ones.
Oh.
If somebody asks you a question, well, you know, you get to, you're not infallible. Do you know everything?
Heck no.
Neither do I. Neither do I know everything. I only know what I've experienced. So there's usually what I do in that case is that I'll be, you know, checking out Google for resources for the people, because Jake can be talking. The nice thing about having two of us on is because we can kind of bounce off of each other. And, you know, I just get online and start asking the question to Google. And the nice thing about what I've done over the past 40 years, I've been gardening for 42 years. The nice thing about what I've done in the past 42 years is that I can get a sense of whether what something somebody is saying is the truth or not.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
I know,
So
like, because I'm always like, I feel like I spend a lot of time these days explaining to people, like, well, in school we call it media literacy. Like, we had to take classes in media literacy, and you have to teach the kids. And it's like, I feel like, you know, I have a pretty good idea of being able to say right away, is that a credible resource? Where are you looking?
Right.
Where are you getting that information
Exactly.
from? Excellent. Okay, cool. Okay, so sorry to interrupt there. So back
Oh,
to,
please, I love it.
so what are the seven courses? Do you want to tell listeners what the seven courses are?
Oh, now you're going to make me rack my brain here. Okay, good. Jumpstart Your Urban Farm is a 4-week online course. It basically talks about urban farming and permaculture and what I call regenerative design. So this notion of sustainability, I don't like it
Why not? What?
because there's something so much more. If we are generally what sustainability speaks to is
Oh.
let's figure out something that will sustain what we've been doing for the past 100 years, which by the way is using up your resources, just a little bit longer. So
Yeah.
I call sustainability a stopgap measure between doing nothing and what's next. And what's next is what we call regenerative design. So how do we create systems that regenerate themselves? Because when you look at nature, if you're looking at nature, nature constantly regenerates itself. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So when we look at nature, we look to see how we can put these regenerative systems in place. That's what I talk about in Jumpstart Your Urban Farm. And then we have Growing Food the Basics and Seed School Online. We have an aquaponics course. Most of these are 7 weeks. The Jumpstart and the Backyard Livestock are 4 weeks. Then we have Permaculture City, which was taught by the late, great Toby Hemingway. And, Urban Farmer 101 was the first course that I did almost 3 years ago online. So those are the seven courses that we give.
So, and tell us how it works. Like, what's a course for gardeners? Like, do you have like assignments? Like, you have to go grow this in your garden? Do you have to start at a certain time? Can you start anytime? Can you take it at your own?
Yep, you can start anytime. The courses are evergreen, and what that means is that you can start them 24/7, any day you want. You just go to our website, Urban Farm U, find the course you want to take and go. And each week, so like I said, most of the courses are 7 weeks in length, and each week is a topic. So in our Growing Food the Basics week, we'll have a week on soil. You know, do you know that the single most important thing that you can do is to build healthy soil in your garden for your success, right? You knew that, right?
Yeah, that's definitely the biggest lesson my podcast has taught me.
Exactly. So then how do you build healthy soil? So we talk about that 1 week, and then we talk about water 1 week, and we talk about fertilizing, nurturing your plants and fertilizing and pest control. And so we talk about all of these things one per week.
Nice. Now, what does that mean? You talk about it like there's a video that they watch, and then is there stuff you have to read? Is there a workbook or anything? Like,
we're actually working on building out workbooks as we speak. And each week comes with an hour to an hour and 15 minute long PowerPoint presentation. So you'll hear in Growing Food the Basics, you'll hear Kari and I presenting. It comes with a PowerPoint presentation, and then it comes with resources to support what you're learning that week. So it comes with PDFs, it comes with other videos, it comes with checklists, those kinds of things. So each week is self-contained in the learning for that week.
I don't know. To me, it reminds me of like thinking back to like when I first joined Podcasters Paradise, like that beginning checklist was so essential. And just it took me like it was like 3 pages, and it took me, I think, at least 6 months, if not almost like I joined in April and I launched in January. So it took me almost a year to get through that first checklist. Like checklists are invaluable.
Oh, yeah.
And
absolutely.
That's excellent. And that sounds like you almost have a workbook put together, like right there. Just
Well, and what we're doing is one of my people, Janice, is going through and listening to the classes and actually making workbooks from the classes.
Oh, nice.
And we'll make them available. So you'll have the PowerPoint presentation lecture, the PowerPoint presentation as a PDF, and then a workbook for each week.
Nice.
Yeah.
And then you could take them all, I guess, eventually if you wanted to, if they all fit your needs. So, and like people are probably thinking like urban farmer, and you have a pretty big place there, but these would apply to anybody, even with like just a little backyard, right?
Yeah.
Like,
so
there was one.
Let's have that conversation since you brought it up.
Okay.
I actually have a third of an acre. So a third of an acre is 80 feet wide and 160 feet deep. And if you walked up my driveway, you would think that my 1950s built house was just nicely landscaped. Until you started looking deeper to see all the food that I've integrated into the landscape. That's all I've done. I've taken my 1950s house and I've integrated food into the landscape.
I love this. Tell us how that works.
So again, permaculture, I'm looking, from a permaculture perspective, we like to call it food foresting. Remember we talked about the nurse trees, the bigger trees providing shade. We design landscapes in 3D. You know, we're not just putting a garden in. We're looking, you know, from the ground up, the ground down for healthy soil, and the different things that can grow. So we can grow perennial trees. We can grow perennial bushes underneath the trees, and then we grow the annual vegetables underneath all of that. All I've done is I've taken my gardening beds that were flower beds, and I've turned them into food production beds. So that's my representation of my urban farm. Now, what I tell people is becoming an urban farmer is simple. You grow food, you share it with somebody, which is what farmers do. You know, they're growing food and they're typically selling it, but grow food and share it and then name your farm. The naming your farm is one of the most important pieces for growing your local food system, for getting people integrated and, you know, growing their own food, is to have a name for it, because then you're starting to create an identity for urban farming where you live. Plus you're starting to create identity for who you are and what you're up to. So that's my urban farming, how you become an urban farmer.
So I was going to ask you, do you help people design? Like if they wanted, like even if they didn't live in Arizona, do you help people do that? Like can they give you like pictures of their backyard and sketches?
One of the things that I've done in the past, I'll do an hour, about a 50-minute long garden consult on the phone where they send me a picture of their pictures of their space and a Google, you know, they send me their address so I can get a Google Earth. But what I'm, cool. And I used to do on-site consults and designs for people, and I found that so many of them, you know, people would pay me $300, $400, $500, and I'd come out and we'd do a design and nothing would ever happen with it. So I decided maybe 5 years ago to teach people how to do this themselves. And that's what Jumpstart Your Urban Farm's about. That's what Growing Food the Basics about. That's what these courses are about. You take these courses and then you get to start designing your space. Because here's the thing. My space at 6750 13th Place in Phoenix is different than my next door neighbor. And the systems that, although we're both in the desert, he's going to put a little bit different system in than I am here. And then if we look at your place in, you said Montana, right?
Yep.
We look at your place in Montana, it's a totally different game up there. What we need to do as learners is learn our space and design from our space.
You know, that is so true. I love the way you put that. And that's really like when I first moved here, I had a bigger interest in real estate and people building, you know, and we were still working on building our house. And I always tell people, like, when you buy your land, you can't do anything better than like spending a weekend in a tent or in a camper or something each right. season on different parts of your property. And you need to know, like my husband had already figured this out and he already put our house where, you know, we have passive solar in the living room. You know, the living room's facing the south and the sun comes in the north, the kitchen's in the north where it's cooler. And, you know, just the way your house is designed, where you want to put it on your property. You know, we have 20 acres and like where he picked to put the house on the 20 acres just even makes a difference. And like if you have right. those options, you know, and with your garden, it's going to be that way for sure. Right.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the biggest things that you can do is have your house face north and south. And not east and west, especially in the desert and really cold climates, because we get a lot of solar loss and solar gain that you don't necessarily need to have on the east and west side.
And what then do you mean by face? I guess I have to like make sure, because like I'm thinking like to me, it seems like our house faces south, even though the front door is in the east, but it seems like... What do you mean by face?
Yes. So the main part of your house, you said your front door faces, your part of your house faces south, right?
Yeah. Like the main living room windows where the heat comes in.
There you go. Here's an example. A friend of mine here in Phoenix, I was in his house maybe 10 years ago. And Chris, really great guy. and he's really conserving on the utilities. So I walk in and it's January and it's kind of cold here, not cold like up there, but you know, it's 50 degrees outside and it gets down to 32 at night. So it, you know, that's cold for us here in Phoenix. And it's like 80 degrees inside his living room. And it's Chris, what are you doing? And he said, concrete in the living room, window faces south. I open up the window during the day. I let the sun warm the concrete, and then I close the, you know, I close the curtains at night, and that heats my house for the night. That's a
With no
south.
other heater, and he just uses the just the sun coming in.
This is passive
Yeah.
heating. I
Yeah.
think he did have another heater, but he was passively heating and cooling his house
Nice.
that way. You can do the same thing in the summertime here with opening windows and that kind of stuff. My problem is my garage is on the south side of the house here. There's, you know, I don't get any of that solar gain in the wintertime, right? So yeah, if your front of your house or your back of your house faces north and south, you are so much far ahead, so much farther ahead on the passive solar heating and cooling arena. Yeah.
And we're right in the middle of that right now with the, open the windows in the morning and then close everything up in the afternoon and try to keep your houses cool all over. Do you want to tell us about something that grew well this year?
So normally tomatoes do really well here, and here's one of my challenges here in the desert. Normally we get a really great crop of tomatoes. We plant them in end of February, early March, from plant start, so they're about 6 inches tall then. By the time mid-May comes around, the tomatoes are just rocking it. Well, in April and May, we had a couple of days. So when we started this conversation before we were on the air, I told you that, and maybe it was even while we were on the air, we're over 100 most days from May 1st to October 1st. And sometime in April and May, we had three different times when it got cool again. So cool that, you know, it was down in the, you know, upper 60s at night, and that slows everything way down.
Isn't that crazy how that happens?
Yeah, and that I've never seen that happen in 50 years of living in Phoenix. I'd never seen that happen here where it got so cold three times in April and May, and that slowed everything way down. So in at the beginning of June, we had this nice flush of a few tomatoes, and then it got hot. And once it gets really hot, and when I say really hot, I mean over 110, the tomatoes just fry. So we had about 2 weeks of really good tomatoes when normally we'll get about 6 or 8 weeks of tomatoes. The things that grow really well here for me are the greens. I love my kale and Swiss chard and, you know, those things, but those are wintertime crops.
My Swiss chard is just coming on now. My spinach already went to seed, but like I was just out there. My Swiss chard is just at its perfect time to cook and harvest. And I like to use Swiss chard like almost instead of spinach because I have such an easier time. So like I'll blanch it and then like things that I would put spinach in the winter, I'll use Swiss chard. So, well, how about, so is there something you're excited to try different or new next year? Like what, something that you haven't done before? You've been doing this for
Yes.
a while.
So,
Oh,
yeah,
cool.
well, and you know, it's all about observation. You know, my task is to look at what happened. We planted most of our tomatoes in a very hot microclimate this year. I don't know what I was thinking. I just put them there and they fried early. If I would have moved them 30 feet to the west, they would have gotten
Really?
afternoon shade. So next spring, the tomatoes are going in the westernmost part of our front yard, which has an eastern exposure. So that's the big thing I'm going to do. So I'm looking for, you know, I'm refining the whole microclimate idea here.
Excellent. That's I think listeners are going to find like that's a really valuable golden seed. I call them, instead of golden nuggets, I call them golden seeds, that they
Nice.
probably don't even realize that they have microclimates in their backyard or in
Right.
their neighborhood. Like they're probably
Yeah.
thinking, we talk about that a lot here, but I usually talk about them being like, you know, somebody who lives like even the people in Eureka. So we're 6 miles south of town, and like my friend who lives right in town, she's usually 3 weeks ahead of me. And then even like just north of town can be 3 weeks ahead of them as far as like
Right.
when their things start to bloom. But I hadn't really realized that there's such intense microclimates right in your
Oh.
own individual backyard.
Oh yeah. Well, and then the other thing that people do here is they put gravel mulch down.
Gravel?
Yeah. It's called granite mulch or gravel mulch. Great way to cook your garden is have gravel mulch around it. Plus, they put up block walls. So both the gravel mulch and the block walls create a much warmer microclimate
Oh, yeah.
that, you know, you need to be paying attention to. Now, there's things you can do to abate that. One of the things that I really encourage people to do, and really everywhere, is, you know, all those wood chips that they're chipping in your neighborhood? It costs them an obscene amount of money to dump those in a city dump.
Oh.
Up to $500 a truckload.
No way.
So going and asking them for those and putting a good 6 or 8 inch layer of woody mulch in,
Yeah.
you know, throughout your entire growing space. You don't want to put that in your growing garden beds because the woody mulch uses up the nitrogen, but in pathways and tree basins around your trees, it's a great way to mitigate heat. It holds water like a sponge, and the interface between the dirt and the wood chip makes this absolutely amazing, happy, healthy soil.
Okay, but let me just like, because I'm actually going to talk to a guy who lives kind of near me down in Whitefish, which is about an hour south of me, who has like a wood chipping business, and he
Oh.
creates like compost for people, and he's doing that. But now you said don't actually put that on your vegetable beds where your food is growing. Is that what you said?
Well, you don't want to, technically, you don't want to add it to your healthy soil in your beds. You can put it on top of the bed if you like, but then, you know, I think you have to go back and take it out later when you go back and replant. So I just try and stay away from that. What I put on top of my garden beds isn't either straw, make sure
That's
it's
what we
organic
use.
straw, or, you know, just compost. Lots and lots of compost.
Yeah. That's what we use. And chicken manure Mike uses because we have chickens.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Well, so then is the tomatoes kind of what you would say for something that didn't work so well this season?
Yeah, that didn't work so well this season.
Okay. Before we get to the root of things, we're going to thank our sponsors and affiliate links. Organifi Green Juice is a gently dried superfood mix that supports health, mental clarity, while detoxifying your body all in one delicious drink. What I love about Organifi, it makes me feel great. It's easy. It doesn't take much time. It's full of nutrients and superfoods that I have a hard time getting anywhere else, and it just tastes delicious. Now, as a teacher, you all know that our time is totally limited. I have kids in my classroom from 7:30 in the morning till 6 o'clock at night. So just even using this simple thing can be difficult for me, but I can pull it off and so can you. If you want to feel good and get all your greens in a simple, easy drink, remember, you can get a discount as an Organic Gardener podcast listener by entering code OGP16, and Organifi will give you a 15% discount now. So just go to Organifi.com, and when you go to checkout, enter code OGP16, and they'll give you 15% off your order anytime. Why do it this way? But why do it this way? Why not just use water-soluble chemical fertilizers? Because plant quality is dependent on a balanced availability of nutrients. This is from Elliot Coleman's The New Organic Grower. He talks about he learned his first important lesson in soil fertility from the United States Department of Agriculture. And he's got his whole chapter on building fertile soil. The lesson, food for plants does not need to be pre-arranged in a factory. Nutrient availability is a result of biological and chemical soil processes that are stimulated by the agricultural practices I learned to use and trust. Crop rotations, green manures, and animal manures. This biological system comes full circle. Each practice aids another, and the result is synergistic. So just one of the great tips in Elliot Coleman's The New Organic Grower, a master's manual of tools and techniques for the home and market gardener. And this book has been recommended on my show by numerous people, published by the great Chelsea Green Publishing, and available to you on Amazon. If you go to the Organic Gardener Podcast website and click on Recommended Books, Elliot Coleman's right at the top, and you can order this book or any other gardening book or anything from Amazon, and it will help support our show. Thanks for listening. And now, let's get to the root of things. So this is where I kind of get to like John's version of the lightning round, and we call it getting to the root of things.
Okay.
So do you have like a least favorite activity to do in the garden? Is there something you have to kind of force yourself to get out there and do?
Oh, you mean like pulling up noxious weeds?
Yeah.
Yeah. Bermuda and nutgrass are amazing to get rid of, and they will take over your garden in no time because unlike most weeds where you can just pull the weed up and if there's a root left in the ground, you're okay. With Bermuda and nutgrass, you have to dig them out completely.
We have, what does Mike call it? Quackgrass here that he's like that about. And just like, he's like, you've got to get every single little tiny piece of that. Like, even if it's like a little white root smaller than my pinky, he's like, get it out of there.
Yeah,
and he just like, he goes through almost every inch of dirt in his beds with like practically his hand. Like he's almost sifted through every single thing. But at the same time, I know Mike does not weed like other people. I mean, he still has to weed, but he makes it look effortless to me. But
yeah,
I've, that really makes a big difference. So I imagine it's very similar. So on the flip side, what's your favorite activity to do in the garden?
chill with a glass of iced tea.
That's nice. a lot of my listeners have said that, like being out with a cup of coffee or taking pictures or just enjoying the garden.
Yeah. A lot of the systems that I've put in place here are based on nature. And once they're in place and running, there's not a lot to do for them. So I just let them be.
Awesome. Well, I think listeners are going to like that because I know a lot of my listeners are kind of like me and they work full time and gardening. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of days this summer, now that I'm finally really on official summer vacation, I've gotten in the garden. But most years, they will go like a whole week and I will not get in the garden. I won't even get down there. Thank God Mike's there to water it and just, I know a lot of listeners. So that's nice to hear. And like Mike's been working on this place, this woman, we still haven't figured out. He said that some people recommended him and he didn't recognize any of the people's names, but told him.
Cool.
So she's been working on this. He's been working on this job and it's quite a ways from our house. So it's like he hasn't been getting there, but it's got an automated water system. So it's been really cool to see that in action, having like an automated water system in play.
Yeah. Big time important.
So how about the best gardening advice you've ever received?
How do you feel about four-letter words on your show? It's a positive one, but it's a four-letter word resembling manure.
I would put a foghorn over it. I try to keep my show rated G.
Okay, good. So Larry Santoyo is one of my permaculture teachers, and he encourages people to go out in the world and do epic. So really get out. Here's what, in fact, I told the girl at the coffee house this morning when I picked up my iced tea, she said, you're all smiles today. And I said, listen, every morning when I get up, I have a choice. I have a choice. Am I going to have a happy day or not have a happy day? So I choose happy day. And the other thing is, I'm always looking for that epic thing to do that will move my, you know, move my movement forward, that'll change the world. So go out and do epic stuff.
Oh my gosh. You are just so fun to talk to. Just like,
well,
this
thanks.
Is the best thing about podcasting, isn't it?
It's
just,
I know,
meeting like-minded folk. I mean, where else
yeah.
am I going to go? Like, I could talk to 1,000 people. I could talk to practically every teacher in my district probably and not meet another person who's as passionate about Jacques Cousteau as I am. And just,
right.
I mean, maybe there's somebody there. But it's just the coolest thing. And I just love that you're talking about, you know, having a movement, making an epic day, like being the best person you can be and just
right.
trying to really actually do something to make our world a better place. Like, one of my all-time favorite heroes is this woman, Jeanette Rankin. She was actually the first woman ever elected to Congress, and she's from here in Montana. And
wow.
like, one of her favorite quotes is, "What if we died not knowing we did everything we could for peace?" And I just, mm-hmm. I always have that kind of in the back of my head, like,
yep.
try to, you know, be optimistic and positive and, you know,
yeah.
believe that we're going to make a, you know, a greener future. So what's your favorite tool? If you had to move and could only take one tool with you, what could you not live without?
Well, we kind of touched on it a little bit. Your broad fork idea.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
I, at a garage sale, it had to have been 25 years ago. There was this guy selling a really heavy duty pitchfork with a really heavy duty handle on it, a metal handle on it. And I use that in the yard every day. It's 8 inches wide. So it's, you know, broad forks are really wide. This guy's only 8 inches wide. It's got four prongs on it. And I have yet to bend it because it's so heavy duty. So that would be the one that I would take with me. And it's, you know, it's a homemade tool by some old timer, you know, 25 years ago.
Awesome. Yep. I have been totally loving our broad fork. I'm so glad I bought it
yeah.
because they have one on Amazon. They're usually like $200 or $300 and they have one for $99. And I was a little hesitant because I was like, is this going to be, you know, flimsy? But trust me, Mike has used it like well over its $99 worth, and just he said right away it was very sturdy. The bolts did come out and we did have to rescrew them in, but you know, you just have to kind of pay attention to that. But that was an easy fix. So I can totally understand your pitchfork.
Yeah.
So what's your favorite recipe to cook from the garden?
The cool thing about my yard is that there's something to eat out there 365 days a year.
Oh, nice.
And a lot of them are weeds. We have lamb's quarters and purslane and mallow, sourgrass. These are all things that just grow in our yard, and we use those in salads. So there's always a meal in the yard. Plus we have chickens, so we get eggs. And I either do my, in the wintertime, I'll do my farm soup, and in the summertime, we do the farm salad. And it's just from whatever is in the yard.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Mike was just telling me the other day that the biggest thing we can do is grow our own food. I mean, really. And I feel like I hear that a lot. And just,
it's
so true that...
Yep.
Well, and I just, like, I get tired of, like, he'll, like, look at my strawberries and be like, those are some yummy-looking pesticides you're eating today, aren't they? And I'll be like,
right.
I know, because, I don't know. So, and also just protecting our planet. Like, anyway, how about a favorite internet resource? Do you want to talk about your website, or you have somewhere else to suggest for listeners? Or
well, urbanfarm.org is great, and... Honestly, I'm 56 years old. I started my first technology company in 1984, and I was in technology for 20 years, and I am sick and tired of technology, and I run a technology business called Urban Farm U. So when I go looking for something, I just ask Google. I know it may be a lame resource, but it, you know, it answers all the questions that you need to have answered.
Nope, I love it. How about a favorite reading material or book? Didn't you say you had something in mind for this?
Yeah, so the other thing that happened in 1991 is I read a book that changed my life forever.
Oh.
And Daniel Quinn is the author. He's got 14 or so books out. I've read them all. And the book is called Ishmael. It's a conversation between a gorilla and a man, and the gorilla is the teacher. And over the course of the book, Ishmael, the gorilla, frames out how we as human beings have come to dominate and destroy the world. And he points to things that can be done to start doing it differently. So, Ishmael by Daniel Quinn, it's an amazing book. It changed my life forever. Then there's Story of Bee and My Ishmael. And, there's, like I said, there's 14 of them or so that are just amazing books. And I call what I believe now Quinnian philosophy for the author Daniel Quinn, because it's the philosophy that I speak about. And really, what it points to is how can we work with nature?
Is he still alive?
He is. And I heard a rumor recently that he's writing another book. He's like
Where
91
does
or
he
something like
live?
that.
Is he in the United States? Oh,
New
cool.
Mexico, I think. I think he's in New Mexico. I met him
Awesome.
once. I met him once
You
about
did?
8 years ago. I did. I was so excited.
Cool.
I took some of my books and had him sign them, and it was just, it was amazing.
Well, don't forget to take your Freedom Journal to have John sign at Podcast
Oh,
Movement.
there you go.
I had him sign mine up at or you're
Oh.
going to Podcast Movement. I had him sign mine at Podmastery. So, now you sell fruit trees? Do you sell vegetables and like do you do farmers market or any of that kind of thing?
When I went back to school late in life, at 39 years old, it was 1998, I ended up back in college.
Me too.
And that was toward the end of my technology period. And one of the things that I did to make money while I was in college from 99 to 04 was I raised food in my front and backyard, and I took it to a farmer's market. And one of the things that I would, it's really simple. Farmers markets are amazingly simple to get into. And one of the big key pieces of that is you want to be consistent. So if you start raising food and take it to a farmer's market, you just want to make sure you're there every week. But for somebody wanting to get into growing food, there's an easier way to get in than going to farmers markets. And that's find a couple of chefs in your area, find out what you can grow for them, and then start growing for them. And often they'll end up buying it from you. So that's a super easy way to get in.
So, my question about that was like last summer when I was working at this restaurant, like they didn't want to buy it from me because I wasn't like an official farm. Like I tried to get them, they wouldn't even use, like I tried to bring in some oregano for them to use and some basil and some stuff for their, some thyme to like kind of flavor their food. And they were really hesitant about me bringing in food that hadn't been like, didn't come from the truck. Or
Yeah,
whatever,
well, there you
from
go.
Spokane
So,
Produce or whatever.
some of the things you get to work around. That's why I say make friends with a farmer or with a chef. Make friends with a chef and
The
they'll
one
love
thing
what
I
you have.
really did learn from working at that restaurant was how much produce they went through and how, like, they would order like 6 heads of romaine. And they would get them like every other day or something. And like that didn't seem as difficult for me as trying to provide for a farmer's market. Like to just
Right,
have to like,
exactly.
no, I need to bring this many heads of lettuce to this one, and just like a couple, like it was very enlightening to see that way. Okay,
Well, and
ready for my final. Oh, go ahead.
the other thing is that when you're asking a chef, there's going to be specialty items there. Water lettuce. There was one of the chefs here in town that was buying water lettuce specifically from a farmer here, and he was the only guy growing it. It's the only place you could get it. So
what is water lettuce?
Yeah, I can't remember, but that's what it was. You know, that's what they were calling it. Oh. It was some specialty item, and you know, you can grow cucumbers, or you can grow Armenian cucumbers. You know, Armenian cucumbers are foot-long cucumbers. They're crunchy as all get out. They're burpless. They're just an amazing cucumber. And you can sell them for a whole lot more.
Excellent.
So.
Okay, ready for my final question?
Sure.
If there's one change you would like to see to create a greener world, what would it be? For example, is there a charity organization you're passionate about or project you'd like to see put into action? Like, what do you feel is the most crucial issue facing our planet in regards to the environment, either locally, nationally, or on a global scale?
So there's really two parts to this question for me. Do you want me to answer it from an environmental perspective or from a humans living on the planet perspective? Because the second part is we need to grow our own food. We need to know how to grow our own food. We need to know how to save our own seeds. The single biggest thing we can do right now is figure that out. From an environmental perspective, that's a different story. Apparently, we just went over 7.5 billion people on the planet. We have way too many people here. We need to do something about that.
Like birth control?
I don't know. Good question. Good question. I'd say more than anything else, education.
Okay. All right. Well, even though you've dropped like a million golden seeds, like, do you have an inspirational tip or quote to help motivate listeners to reach into the dirt and start their own garden?
Yeah. Growing food is actually really simple. You just have to learn the rules for where you're at. And that's a lot of the courses that we do really speak to. How do you learn the rules for where you're at? Because it can be as easy as growing basil in your windowsill. And what that takes is to jump in, grow something, don't get discouraged, because I promise you, you're going to kill something. I know I have killed more than you'll ever kill in your lifetime. Not on purpose, but that's how we learn. When we fail, in my podcast, it's the urbanfarmpodcast.com. And on our podcast, I'm always asking people for their, you know, what's their failure? What have you failed at? And what did you learn from it? Because that's where we learn the most. Don't be afraid to fail, because that's where we can figure this stuff out at.
That's so true. And, you know, like you said, just starting with your, like, this year, because really my husband's really the gardener at our house. And I've kind of, like, when I started my podcast, I would tell people, like, I've probably learned enough. If I had to, like, feed some a family, like if the world collapsed or something, I probably mm-hmm. could. But this year, I actually grew lettuce on my windowsill in my classroom to feed our guinea pig. But let me tell you, that guinea pig probably eats more salad than most listeners would eat in a day. Certainly more than I couldn't believe when I first started buying him food. I was like spending $6 a day on this guinea pig, like, because lettuce was outrageous in February this year in March. So, you know, you're right. You can grow just a little bed of lettuce that you can just keep going. Like, you can start with something small like that. Okay, tell people how to connect with you one more time.
Perfect. So urbanfarm.org is our website. podcast@urbanfarm.org is our email address. You can get us through that. And urbanfarmpodcast.com.
If you know somebody who would benefit from the Organic Gardener podcast, we would just love it if you would share it with a friend. Thanks again for listening, and remember to grow.